In my 40-year history of broadcasting, I have never endorsed a weight loss product because most don't deliver until now. Science behind CaloCurb is so compelling that I can support it as a plausible alternative for curbing appetite and enhancing satiety to help you shed pounds. The active ingredient in CaloCurb, Amerisate, comes from a specific New Zealand-grown hops flower, which works by activating your body's own appetite-regulating chemical messengers, including GLP-1, which signals specific areas of the brain to effectively manage hunger in just 1 hour. CaloCurb is clinically proven to reduce hunger by 30%, cravings by 40%, and calorie intake by an average of 18%. CaloCurb is a safe, effective, and affordable natural appetite-suppressing supplement made in the United States with no chemicals, synthetics, or caffeine, and it doesn't cause jitters. Take control of your eating habits and cravings naturally with CaloCurb. For more information and order, just go to CaloCurb.com. That's CaloCurb.com. Use coupon code DH10 for 10% off. That's CaloCurb.com. Coupon code DH10 for CaloCurb. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is a post-4th of July edition of Q&A with Layla. Presumably, all of you fared well over the holidays, ready to get down to business a little bit. Lots of news. So we've got the Tour de France going on. We've got lots and lots of presidential election news going on. Hot and heavy drama at the White House. And we've got the Summer Olympics going on. So, yeah, it's quite the entertainment menu. But perhaps you can spend an hour or so with us today, because we've got some useful health information for you. Today, I'm with Layla Mutin, who's our resident nutritionist, and together we answer questions every week on our weekly Q&A with Layla. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And so we have our usual mailbox. Questions come to questions at drhoffman.net. And so what we're going to do is field your questions momentarily. We're happy to have a great mailbox full of questions. Thanks, as always, to our listeners for coming up with interesting questions and or comments or experiences. You know, perhaps you've tried this or you tried that and you want to share with our listening audience, our vast community of intelligent medicine listeners, your success or failure thereat, using, you know, whatever modality we may have been talking about in this program, or, you know, perhaps you've had an experience of medical mayhem that you want to bring to light. We're happy to also hear from you. So it doesn't have to be in a question form. It can be a comment or a shared experience. So before we get to that, I just wanted to comment on, we had a question, and it didn't seem like a very consequential question at the time. It was somebody who asked me about dietary oxalates, and I had an interview with Sally K. Norton, who's written a controversial book called Toxic Superfoods, in which she contends that dietary oxalates can be responsible not just for kidney stones, which is something that we've known for decades, but also for a wide gamut of symptoms. The symptoms could be pain syndromes, neurological symptoms, gastrointestinal problems, urological problems. It's also been proposed that high oxalates are sometimes responsible for urinary symptoms or vulvar pain syndromes, vulvodynia.
Vulvodynia, yeah.
Oxalates, so she's not the first to contend that. But anyway, the point being is that, you know, talking about peanuts, the concern was, were peanuts a source of oxalates, and have I
eaten
peanuts? And so that prompted me to write an entire article, which will be posted next week. So those of you who subscribe to our newsletter, you'll get it in your inbox. Those of you who do not, worry not, because you can always go to drhoffman.com and you can click on the article once it's published. So what's your take on peanuts and peanut butter, Layla? Because you know, I kind of geeked out on peanut butter. I wrote a whole lot about the various nutritional pros and cons about peanut butter. By the way, peanut butter is touted as a great food, a source of protein, vegetarian source of protein, and healthy fat, so they say, because it's it has virtually no saturated fat, no cholesterol. It's touted as a great alternative to cheese and other high fat or high cholesterol sources of protein, and kids love it. You know, PB&J is a staple. So what say you?
Well, peanut butter. Is that, well, can I still eat my peanut butter? Everybody loves peanut butter. I try to turn them on to macadamia nut butter or some other kind of thing, almond butter or something. Peanuts are a legume. They're not really a nut.
Exactly.
But they are high in oxalate. Peanuts and peanut butter are classified as high oxalate foods.
Mm-hmm.
Peanuts can also tend to get moldy, so they're sprayed with a lot of antifungals,
right.
And a toxic byproduct of all that is aflatoxin.
Right.
This can be very hard.
Let me just weigh in on that, because I did consider that. Aflatoxins are more of a problem in the third world, where they cultivate peanuts in tropical conditions, and then they store them in conditions where they can be mold infested, especially with aspergillus mold, which, as a byproduct of aspergillus mold, you get aflatoxins, which actually are very dangerous. They can cause cancer, they're liver cancer, they can cause all manner of very, very serious health problems. However, because that is such a serious problem, you know, as you state, it's very carefully controlled here. Maybe, you know, it's substituting one problem for another, because in order to suppress fungal growth on peanuts, peanuts may be highly sprayed, and they're maybe using antifungals and various types of herbicides and pesticides on peanuts. Peanuts are vulnerable to insect predators, and, you know, there's also possibility of fungal infections and weed infestation. So, yeah, peanuts are among the most highly herbicide and pesticide sprayed agricultural products. And hence, it's a really good idea to get organic. Now, organic is not going to completely eliminate the problem. It's going to be a little bit of a risk mitigation strategy. But I would say this aspergillus thing for the U.S. anyway, unless you're growing your own peanuts. I know you're like a great home gardener. You get peanuts growing in your...
We're not doing peanuts, no.
Okay. You know, Long Island is not renowned as a peanut growing mecca. You know, it's not Georgia, you know.
Yeah.
So when it comes to oxalates, actually, oxalate content of peanuts is moderate compared to some real classic high oxalate foods, like rhubarb takes the champion, I think. Spinach is very high. Many green leafy vegetables deliver a lot of oxalates.
True.
Potato skins, cocoa, tea, moderately
beets.
High, you know, pretty high. So the question is this of practical importance for someone who doesn't have a history of kidney stones? And in my opinion, the moderate amount that is in peanuts, you know, for occasional use, it's not going to be a big deal. Now, I got to say that there are some people who have mysterious pain syndromes who respond to low oxalate diets.
Oh, absolutely. Wow.
Autoimmunity, perhaps.
Yeah.
And, you know, but elimination of peanuts may serve a lot of purposes. I mean, they're a little hard to digest, for one thing. Mm-hmm. They have a high content of trypsin inhibitors. So the people may get benefits from stopping peanuts, especially raw peanuts. I think when you roast the peanuts, you kind of destroy the trypsin inhibitors.
Deactivate the trypsin inhibitors. Yes.
So they become less like eating beans and more like eating, you know, roasted nuts.
Raw beans can be toxic, downright toxic. Wow.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't think that's not the main rationale for not having peanut butter. For me, the main rationale for not having peanut butter is because it's a trigger food. I'm just off to the races with peanut butter.
You know, I have to tell you, I hear most often, and this is the mistake that's made when people make a big change in their diet and they get rid of all the processed stuff, they stop eating the potato chips. It's that same motion of, you know, from the canister or the bag into the mouth kind of thing.
Yep.
The nuts take over that particular activity. And it's very easy to overdo because nuts and peanuts,
they're legal.
They have a lot of calories.
They're quote legal, right? You know,
they're legal.
Yeah.
They're legal, but they have a lot of calories.
Yeah. In fact, one statistic is that per weight, peanut butter has more, 50% more calories than cheese. Okay.
Wow.
So I think it's like, I have a statistic. I'll, you know, keep talking. I'm going to look this up.
Oh, okay. All right. So coming back to the trypsin inhibitors for a moment, if you're eating raw nuts and you're wondering why you have any kind of indigestion or GERD or reflux, heartburn, it could be the raw nuts. Because they have naturally containing trypsin inhibitors, and what that means is they inhibit our own digestive juices. When we don't digest, we get indigestion or GERD or reflux, or we get constipated, or both.
Yeah.
But roasting them helps to kind of deactivate, you know, mellow out those trypsin inhibitors so they're more easily digested. This is where raw is not better.
Right. Now, there is one downside to the roasting, and I came across a study. You know, there's this very high prevalence of peanut allergy, and we ascribe it to many factors, you know, the hygiene hypothesis, too many antibiotics, poor diets, food additives, glyphosate, perhaps damaging the intestinal tract. You know, all manner of things may contribute to a higher risk of developing an allergy to a food.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that in research using experimental rodents, roasting peanuts somehow changes the proteins to make them more allergenic, okay? And renders the mice or rats more susceptible to a severe peanut allergy after they've ingested the roasted peanuts. So it may be, I mean, there are advantages to the roasting. I'm not saying don't have roasted. By the way, roasted is super yummy, much yummier than
raw. Oh, yeah, when you roast nuts, it develops its flavor.
Yeah. So, so actually, I looked up the statistic because I was going to recite it from memory, but I thought, wow, that's a little bit implausible. But it turns out to be true. 2 tablespoons of peanut butter, 188 calories.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. And hello, everybody. So you understand a tablespoon is not a big heaping tablespoon.
Yeah.
It's a level tablespoon.
Yeah.
And when people dig in with their spoon, they're coming out with heaping.
And that tablespoon is likely to go back into that peanut butter jar again and again and again. But another problem with peanut butter is to point out is that it's often, there's hydrogenated oil added to peanut butter and mono and diglycerides and sugar. And partly it's to solve a problem, which is that peanut butter separates, the oil separates, you know, if it sits there for a long time, you have to shake it up and stir it. And when you put in hydrogenated oil, it kind of homogenizes the peanut butter, makes it more aesthetically appealing. But it's also a cheap ingredient that kind of is a peanut butter extender, but it's bad for you. So go for, you know, look at the label. And the only 2 ingredients should be in peanut butter are peanuts and salt. That's it.
That's it.
Often you'll see like in the supermarket aisles, you'll see like peanut butter with like chocolate swirls or jelly swirls or even marshmallow swirls.
Oh my God.
You know,
it's like a s'more. Okay.
Like a s'more, right?
Yeah.
A s'more or s'more or whatever it's called.
S'more, s'more.
Yeah, s'more.
It's not
s'more in a jar. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, ready to go right on your graham cracker. Yeah. So, So I started writing about peanuts, and I wrote 1,600 words. I mean, there's a lot to say about it. So, you know, in that article, I'm going to try and dispel some myths. But my personal choice is, having a jar of peanut butter is a little bit akin in the house. It's a little bit akin to having like a pint of Häagen-Dazs in the freezer. You know,
Sure.
It's a enticing temptation.
Yeah. I've often heard of people, what do you have for dessert later? Oh, I eat some peanut butter.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you've just had dinner, 2 tablespoons, 188 calories. So anyway, just saying, you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not inalterably opposed to the peanut butter, as I mentioned in the article.
Sure.
I will have.
It is delicious.
If I'm like diving, a great pleasure is after diving, they give you like a little snack, you know, and like you're really tired after diving because, you know, mm-hmm. sort of you're gassing off nitrogen and the exertion of it. And you're hungry because you really don't want to eat a big meal before diving. So, you know, clamber back up on the dive boat and they give you like brownies or they give you like Oreo cookies, which I normally don't eat. Or sometimes they have the ultimate treat, which is Reese's cups.
Peanut butter cups. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
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 They're awesome.
That's a favorite of a lot of people.
Right.
My husband included.
I restricted to dive trips. I also noted this is when I was on a macrobiotic diet, which is a very, very low fat diet and kind of a calorically restricted diet. One of my outs was I would get the peanut butter and, you know, the tablespoon would go in the peanut butter and I'd lick that tablespoon, because, you know, I guess my body was craving fat.
Sure. Yeah, we need fat. It's an essential macronutrient.
Yep.
More so than we ever thought.
Yep.
In fact.
All right, so you can read an entire treatise on the subject of peanut butter.
On peanuts, peanut butter, yay.
Yeah. coming up in the newsletter next week. Okay, great. Right. So let's, this is a good point to pause before we get to questions because we want to allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. So here goes, listen up.
As you know, I'm a big proponent of CBD to tonify the endocannabinoid system, which regulates many of our most critical bodily functions, such as learning and memory, emotional processing, sleep, temperature and pain control, and inflammatory and immune responses. CBD is a real breakthrough in herbal products. But you may not know that CBD can deliver the same healthful results for your pets. The CBD brand that I take personally and recommend to my patients is Plus CBD from CB Sciences, which is now proud to introduce Premier CBD Chews tailored for dogs. Plus CBD pet wellness treats are crafted with the utmost care and supported by extensive research validated by a landmark safety study backed by the National Animal Supplement Council. There are two varieties, Plus CBD Pet Hip and Joint Health Chews and Plus CBD Pet Calming Care Chews. To learn more and to order, visit pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman and use coupon code Hoffman30 for 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for Plus CBD's pet wellness blends.
Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They are what make intelligent medicine a continuing source of free information for you through their generous underwriting. So back to our questions. Let's get started.
We've got a question here from Lisa. Lisa says, I've recently heard about the new Ornish study on low protein, low fat vegan diet for Alzheimer's. What say you?
Okay.
And by the way, this is in the journal Alzheimer's Research and Therapy. It was published June 7 of this year. Dean Ornish is the lead author. You know, Dr. Hoffman and I have both looked at it, are looking at it, and all of that, which is very, very interesting. So it was like a 20-week study of about 51 people. I think two people dropped out. It might have been 49, 50
people. So not older people? Oh, yeah, it says, actually, 45 to 90.
73.
And they did have mild cognitive impairment or early dementia, Alzheimer's dementia. They didn't just take, you know, healthy people. They took people who had evidence of cognitive impairment. By the way, very, very timely study in view of the national drama that's unfolding here. You know, the question, you know, does he or doesn't he? You know, it's kind of like, some days he's on, some days he's off. And, you know, it's kind of features this problem. And I think a lot of people are saying, wow, you know, I'm 78 or I'm 82 or I'm right around that age. And like, wow, am I going to be like that?
Right. So something to think about, right? So this study was about 20 weeks or so, and the average age was about 73. And what's interesting is the diet, yeah, it's a vegan diet, whole foods, minimally processed, which is very good. Lots of fruits, vegetables, there's legumes, there were seeds, nuts, soy products, whole grains, and approximately 18% of calories is total fat, and about 18% protein.
That is low fat. That's low fat.
Yeah. That's very...
And probably very low cholesterol and low saturated fat, right?
Yeah.
Mostly from the fat comes from, is inherent in some of the foods that are, you know, maybe some avocados or some olive oil or things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what they found was some benefit to this, that they did find improvement, but it included a lot of things. Besides the diet, there was group support, there was stress management, there was exercise, but then there's a list of supplements, Dr. Hoffman.
Yeah.
Including things like omega-3 fatty acids with curcumin.
Yeah. Which is, by the way, that's kind of interesting because the one thing that a vegetarian diet does not give you
is
are
omega-3
fatty acids. So this is sort of applying a correction to a vegetarian diet. I know that Dr. Cornish is well known as a vegetarian advocate or vegan advocate, low fat.
And this is vegan. So there's, you have to supplement with a whole lot more.
Yep. Exactly.
And one of the other supplements is coenzyme Q10.
Coenzyme
You're not
going
to find much of that in your vegetables.
Exactly. Right? Your body has to synthesize it, or you can get it from eating like beef, or especially like beef heart or something like that. Right?
Yes. And also B12 was supplemented here.
And yes, B12 could be very important for a cohort like that. Some interesting other ones, magnesium 3 and 8.
Yes.
Which is thought to be the type of magnesium that it has crosses the blood-brain barrier more readily than regular magnesium. There's also curcumin, I think, was in that lineup.
Yes.
Because there's some brain benefits to curcumin as an anti-inflammatory. There's also, interestingly, some type of mushroom.
Yeah.
There was the
lion's mane
mushroom, which is reputed to have cognitive benefits. Mm. So, yeah.
So there's that. There's also, we talked super bifido plus probiotic.
Right, because
so there was
the
probiotic
the brain
formula.
Accent.
There was a multivitamin mineral formula.
Right, covering all bases.
And listen, it's very well known that vegans are going to be low in minerals, hence the multivitamin mineral formula.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So these are, So is the vegan diet alone helpful in this regard? What would happen without these supplements is my question.
Well, okay, so let's look at the study before we, talk about some reservations we might have of it. The duration was 20 weeks, right? Which is like, half a year,
Yeah,
Roughly. I mean, less than half.
About 4.5 months. Yeah.
Right. So one might argue that's kind of a short time to demonstrate cognitive benefits of a diet, right? Because this is a very slow process of neurodeterioration. Nonetheless, according to some measures, he found the people perked up and had better cognitive scores.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, I think, relatively acute benefits of this diet. This doesn't speak to the long-term benefits of such a diet, if pursued for 5 or 10 or 20 years,
But I want to correct something.
Sure.
We're saying the benefit of this diet. It's not just the benefit of the diet without these supplements.
We don't know. It is a multifactorial approach.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
So it's good because I don't think that we should approach cognitive decline with one tool alone. I think we need an all of the above approach, even if there's pharmaceuticals that confer benefit. Although most of them, are sketchy in terms of their benefits and they've got a lot of side effects.
Yeah.
And I think there's also some work that has been done by Dale Bredesen, who is one of the foremost researchers on this, who actually uses the opposite diet, a diet that is, fairly plentiful protein, including animal protein. There are also some studies that show that the diametrically opposed diet, the ketogenic diet, which is very high fat, like 70% fat, lots of animal fat and protein, has cognitive benefits. So one could argue that simply any kind of diet restriction that optimizes weight is going to be beneficial. You know, so whether you say don't eat, purple food or something like that, or time-restricted eating, don't eat between the hours of, 8 p.m. and 10 a.m.,
Right,
that,
right.
Whatever you don't put in your pie hole.
That's what it is.
By the way, the commonality of these diets is that they're all natural foods diets. They eliminate highly processed foods and sugar. And
no junk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably alcohol, right?
I would imagine, yeah. I'm not saying anything in particular about that, but I would imagine nobody would be told, oh, a glass of red wine a day is good for you. Well, no, it's not, actually. Yeah.
So, I congratulate Dr. Ornish for doing a study like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very ambitious study. It is a relatively small cohort. It's hard to get 20 people to comply with such a rigorous program for a relatively long time. 20 weeks is a big commitment. And by the way, I will mention that it wasn't just subjective because, frankly, you get recruited for a study with Dean Ornish that's supposed to show how great lifestyle is for your cognitive function, and that may improve your cognitive function, right? Because you're really... A lot of belief is strong, placebo effect.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
However, they did do an objective measure of what are called amyloid proteins mm-hmm. that are considered a marker, the ratio of a couple of different amyloid proteins, sometimes a ratio of like a biological indicator of the severity of Alzheimer's or cognitive degeneration. Yeah. And there weren't objective improvements. So, to the argument that, the whole thing is kind of a placebo effect, you spend a lot of time. By the way, exercise, let's mention exercise. Walking,
totally.
Right?
Yes, aerobic, at least 30 minutes a day, and mild strength training at least 3 times a week, which is ideal for strength training. From an exercise physiologist, either in person or virtual, patients were given personalized exercise prescriptions mm-hmm. based on age and fitness level.
Mm-hmm.
And all sessions were overseen by a registered nurse.
So there
was oversight. Yeah.
So you could say, well, what was it? Could you replicate that with just lion's mane mushroom, and forget all the other stuff?
Mm-hmm.
But, it's likely that these things had kind of a synergistic or additive effect.
Yeah.
There was also, I think, social interaction was a component of this.
Yes. Right? Group support. Participants, their spouses or study partners, they participated in a support group, 1-hour session, 3 days a week,
mm-hmm.
supervised by a mental health professional. Now, that's quite supportive, days a week.
Loneliness and isolation are,
they're huge.
Big factors, right?
Absolutely. Also, there was stress management. There was meditation. There was gentle yoga. There was progressive relaxation, breathing, imagery.
Did they do it in like brain puzzles, like brain teasers or any of that kind of stuff? Was that part of that? I didn't notice.
I did not see that here.
Yeah, studies are controversial about that. A lot of people are like watching Jeopardy, hoping that, playing brain games. It's controversial as to whether they, the benefits are because of rehearsal. In other words, you get used to the game and you do better. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're smarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So
anyway, interesting study.
Yeah. Interesting study. And hopefully it will continue after the, that they will be followed maybe even further. But I imagine it would be hard to follow this kind of very regimented program for a long period of time. So if they were to invest in going further with this, it would be interesting. But again, I'd want to know the difference between vegan diet alone without the supplements and this study, honestly.
Yeah. Honestly. Yeah, one might keep all the other pieces in place and just say,
put
the people on like the diametrically opposed diet, put them on a keto diet.
And Dr. Hoppen, at the end of the day, and this is my bone to pick with this, at the end of the day, if they come out saying vegan diet is better, like, well, not without the B12 and not without the CoQ10 and not without the omega-3. So what are we talking about?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, it's like saying, you know, go on the carnivore diet, but make sure that you take, carotenoid supplements and, polyphenol supplements and things like that, the things that might be missing from the carnivore diet, you know, so it's not really like a total evaluation of the efficacy of the carnivore diet, because you're supplementing with what it may lack.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Yeah.
Anyway, Lisa, thank you for sending us this this study. This is very, very thoughtful.
Yeah.
And we'll look at it further and we'll look to see what else becomes of this subsequently. So
at the very least, a tantalizing study that adds to the evidence that lifestyle, including diet, can have a significant effect on slowing the progression of cognitive decline.
Are all about what we put in the pie hole.
Exactly.
As you said.
Okay, good stuff. All right, well, let's pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. And part two, we're really going to hunker down and answer questions. So give us a preview of what we're going to hear about in part two.
We've got actually two questions about Pepcid. I can't get off Pepcid, famotidine. I can't get off it. This is what I do. What should I do? And also, another question is, if I have Barrett's and I take Pepcid, can I take hydrochloric acid?
Okay. We'll focus on those questions when we return and others. The place to send questions at drhoffman.net. And that's how you can participate in a future edition of our weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be right back with more. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.